From WUOT News, I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and this is Dialogue. Our knowledge of the universe has changed dramatically over the course of the last half century. At that time, the gas giants Jupiter and Saturn were blurry dots seen through telescopes. Distant galaxies were mysterious. And even the face of our nearest neighbor, the moon, had not been seen or mapped in any great detail. Today, cosmologists are piecing together the universe's earliest moments, measuring the rapid expansion of space, and using ever more powerful tools to probe the big questions of the cosmos. Three panelists will join me this hour to discuss those big questions and tell us about new discoveries that are helping shape our view of this great big neighborhood we call the universe. Join us for Dialogue after the news.
Support for NPR comes from Wix.com, enabling over 30 million local businesses to create customized websites with the Wix website builder at wix.com.
Six minutes after 1 o'clock Eastern Time on Wednesday, today the 8th of May. Good afternoon, I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, and this is Dialogue from WUOT News. It's pretty easy for us today to conceive that something as big as the universe has a lot to discover. But if you turn the clock back just 100 years, less than a blink of an eye in cosmic terms, our idea of that universe was significantly different. In 1913, Einstein's relativity equations were still waiting to be tested. Astronomers thought the entire universe was contained within the Milky Way galaxy, and that everything they could see through telescopes was fairly close by. In 1925, along came an astronomer named Edwin Hubble, and he said not only is the universe much larger than anyone thought, but that it was getting bigger. In the 1950s, humans began to tentatively reach away from the Earth through unmanned satellites and then manned missions to the moon, then space probes that studied nearly everything from the charred surface of Mercury to the frigid moons of the outer planets. In 1990, a telescope the size of a school bus called Hubble, yes, that Hubble, again rewrote the textbooks of astronomy and cosmology, challenging our views of the universe yet again. So what will our descendants think about our current knowledge? What will they say about our understanding 100 years from now? Well, that conversation we hope in part starts today. Joining us this hour on Dialogue is Mike Guidry. He's a professor of physics and astronomy at the University of Tennessee, whose specialty is the study of stellar objects. Linda Kay is a geologist who studies sedimentary rocks, and that comes in quite handy for her latest project, working on analyzing results from the exciting Curiosity rover mission, now on Mars. And Angela Quick is a librarian at Maryville College, a member of the Smoky Mountain Astronomical Society, and she's taught courses on stargazing and the moon. Welcome to all three of you to Dialogue.
Thank you. Good to be here.
Good to be here.
Well, good to have all of you. You know, whenever I hear astronomers and cosmologists talking about their work, there's an audible quality of wonder in their voices. There's something that resonates within us when we talk about these great mysteries. So I'd like to open the hour by getting to know you guys a little bit better about asking, what is it that's so exciting about what you do with your work in space? And Dr. Kay, we'll start with you. Of course, you're an earthbound geologist, but your latest project is really quite exciting, looking at results from Mars.
Yes, you have to start with me because I may be the one person who's working in outer space that lacks the gene to say, oh my gosh, it's Mars. I very much am a terrestrial geologist and personally want to keep my feet on the ground. But what intrigues me are the questions that can be asked. I don't actually have any direct wonder that it's on a different planet. There are fundamental questions about how ancient environments looked, what planetary evolution looked like, and how life can arise in planetary systems. And these questions are the same whether or not you're looking on the Earth or on Mars. And those are the questions that fascinate me.
Angela Quick, you're a member of the Astronomical Society. You've taught some classes on stargazing. What's exciting about looking up?
There's nothing that's not exciting about going outside and looking up. Even if you're in the middle of the city, you see the moon, you see planets. If you're fortunate enough to travel someplace with very dark skies, the skies literally open up and you see more and more and more. And for me, being able to connect with that natural wonder and that natural beauty and study natural history as it's traditionally understood is a wonderful thing. And then once you start to look up and see what's there, you can connect it to human understanding and culture and art and music and literature. The sky is a reflection of us, and I think it's interesting to go look at it and see ourselves reflected.
Dr. Guedry, you study the stars, so how are the Kardashians these days? No, but you study the very, very far away stuff, stars that are billions of light years away. What's exciting about that?
Well, I think it's in general rather exciting to think that science can allow us to understand the universe that we live in. And as you said, we concentrate on studying things that are a great distance away, and yet the physics that underlies those things is similar or the same physics as processes on the Earth. So we also learn something about physics on the Earth from studying those distant objects.
Sort of speaking a universal language of mathematics and physics, right?
Yeah, that's the assumption in astronomy and astrophysics and physics, that there are universal physical laws that govern the entire universe, and our task is to try to understand what those physical laws are.
Right. Well, we'll keep a foot on the Earth and a foot on Mars as we go back to Dr. K to talk a little bit about this. Of course, you and I have had a number of conversations as this mission has progressed from launch to interplanetary cruise to landing on the surface of Mars, and now Curiosity's been there a little less than a year and is doing some fascinating work. What's new on Mars?
Actually, 2013 has been fantastic. Right before Christmas, we entered an area that we call Yellowknife Bay, and we sort of wandered around that area for a while, looking at the rocks, trying to understand the environments in which we might be looking, and in particular, trying to find the perfect locality where we could do something new. And that something new was to actually drill a hole in a rock and then ingest the powder that was made as we drilled into the rover and analyze it. Now, anyone who's followed Curiosity knows that back at last fall, we actually scooped up some dirt, some sediment from the surface, ingested that, and looked at its composition. But drilling into a rock is an entirely different thing. When you're looking at surface sediment, you're looking at material that could be homogenized or mixed over the entire surface of Mars. When you drill into a rock, you're looking at the chemistry of that particular rock, and we've had some fabulous results.
You know, that's an interesting point that you make about where it came from, because the soil on Mars could have been transported by dust storms that we know sometimes girdle the entire planet.
Exactly.
It could have been forces of water or other kind of erosional agents that sort of mix everything up. Does that make it a little harder to study the soil? Would you prefer looking just at the rocks because you know exactly what you're getting in context?
Well, I think we have to do both. I mean, we particularly went for soil for our first sample because we have analyses of soil from other landed missions, and we have an understanding from orbital missions as well. And of course, with a new rover back on Mars, one of our first tasks is to make sure that we can calibrate our equipment. And so this mixing of dirt in the atmosphere during these large dust storms through time, as the wind carries it over the surface, gives us something that we can then calibrate between different missions and different instruments. But the rock really is fantastic. And, you know, we can go into some of those results if you'd like or when you'd like.
Sure. Well, I'd like to zoom out for just a second and explain perhaps to our listeners who haven't been following the mission too closely that it's in a crater right now called Gale Crater near the Martian equator. And there was a very specific reason that that location was picked and that it had some indication that you could find some good sedimentary rocks there. Why is Gale Crater such an important landing site for the work that Curiosity is setting out to do?
Well, Curiosity's primary mission is to try to understand whether or not past environments on Mars could have been inhabited by microbial life. And as we know, the Earth and microbial systems on the Earth, we're basically looking for three factors. We're looking for water, the presence of water. This is the medium in which chemical reactions happen, and it is a necessary component of all biology as we know it. We also need sources of energy, and we need some sort of chemical nutrient. But out of all of these, it's really easy to come up with sources of energy. Sunlight is a source of energy. Electrical energy from storms, thunderstorms, and lightning. As far as nutrients, these are the chemicals that are part of the rocks that make up the surface of any planet. And so nutrients are widely available. Energy is widely available. It's water that isn't always available. And from all of our orbital information from Gale Crater suggested that not only was there water there at one time, but there might have been multiple episodes of water across a rather large period of time.
We'll come back to the Mars Curiosity mission a little later on this hour. And by the way, for all of our listeners joining us wherever you are in this universe, at 15 minutes after the hour, you can submit questions to us on Twitter at WUOTFM. We also have a little post set up on our Facebook page where you can submit questions. And of course, we'll open the phone lines here in about 5 or 6 minutes at 974-5050. You can give us a call and ask your questions about all kinds of stuff going on above our heads. For now, I want to go to Angela Quick and talk to you a little bit about the moon, something that's very interesting to me. Carl Sagan, a man who dreamed of going to the stars and doing all kinds of things, a man who was endlessly fascinated with the universe, didn't much care for the moon, actually. He always said that it was boring, and I don't know if it was just too close, it was too easy a target, and sitting up there all big and gray. I don't know what it was. But I wondered, if you encounter somebody like that or somebody with that interpretation, what do you do to tell them the moon is not a boring place?
Well, the first thing I do is to say it's not boring because you can always see it. Mm-hmm. As long as you have a decently clear sky, you can go outside, point your own eyes or binocular or a small telescope at the moon and see a lot of detail. So it's an excellent object to get people started looking at the skies because it's widely available no matter where you are. And with very modest equipment, you can always start to see really interesting things on the moon, things that are being studied in detail by current missions, geologic formation, craters, rays, lava flows in the mare. All these things are visible on the moon as kind of a textbook sandbox example of what you can see in the skies.
You know, and that's an interesting point. One of the reasons that scientists were so intrigued with the moon in the 1950s and 60s, at the dawn of the space program, was they felt the moon could be used as a sort of a Rosetta Stone for interpreting other features that could be found on Mars, on Mercury, the other terrestrial planets or asteroids.
That's correct.
What have we learned? A lot, I guess.
Well, it's interesting. We've learned a lot, and then we haven't really answered any questions, right? So there's mm-hmm. this theory about how the moon happened, and I happen to have a six-year-old who's in kindergarten right now, and he watches some shows where one of the episodes talks about how did moons come to be, and they explain it in very simplistic terms that the planet Venus decides she wants to get her own moon, and how could she go about doing that, right? But there are all these theories about how the moon formed. And as data comes in, scientists sort. They say, well, this fits this theory, this fits that theory. But we don't have an answer yet, right? Mm-hmm. We don't have an answer. We have data that fits better or data that doesn't fit. We get more nuance and more detail. But if you had to ask someone, how did the moon form? They'll give you a probability or what they think, but we can't say definitively yet. Yeah. So there's still this aura of mystery out there.
And it also shows how new some aspects of astronomy really are, because even up into the Apollo missions of the late 1960s and early 70s, there were fundamental unanswered questions about what the moon was made of, where it came from, how old it was. I mean, these questions that now we sort of take for granted, we had no answers around the time my parents were born. You know, I mean, that's really surprising to me that this is still such a new field, and I guess that means there's so much more left to discover.
There's plenty left to discover.
All right. Well, on that note, we're going to pause right now for a station break, 18 and a half minutes past the hour of 1 o'clock. Remember, you can call in with your questions at 974-5050, joined by Dr. Mike Guidry, Dr. Linda Kay, and Angela Quick on Dialogue from WUOT News. After the hour on Dialogue from WUOT News, I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Thanks for joining us this month as our topic is space, the universe, you, me, everything inside of it. And Dr. Mike Guidry of the University of Tennessee, I want to jump over to you for just a moment. Sometimes I run into people who say, oh, yes, yes, I love space and stars and planets. I just can't get enough astrology. The difference is more than semantic, that what they mean is astronomy, but there really is a difference. It's not just a different word. Those are really two separate realms. I wonder if you would just talk to us a little bit about what separates astronomy from astrology so that we don't make that semantic mistake.
Okay. Well, I know something about astronomy. I'm not an expert on astrology, so...
Maybe that's a starting point.
That's a starting point. Basically, it's the difference of the scientific method, that astronomy is a science and astrology is not. And so, although historically one must say that modern astronomy actually grew out of astrology.
That's true. A lot of the earliest sort of pioneers of theories about the solar system and the universe did have a foot in the field of astrology. But today, of course, we seem to have, gotten a more of a scientific handle on that, which I think has a lot to do with going away from sort of, I guess the reason that was astrology was sort of a part of an explanation for things that were at the time unexplainable, for which we now have much better explanations and much better data, correct?
That's true. Also, in many cases, people like Kepler, for example, who made tremendous contributions to our modern understanding of the solar system, also was an astrologer. And one of the reasons that he did astrology was that that's what he got paid to do.
You got to keep the lights on.
Yeah,
you
that's
gotta
right.
Do
the,
that.
The,
yes.
The emperors tended to fund astrologers. And so in that time, the 1500s, the 1600s, it was not uncommon to see a mix of what we would now call science and what we would now call astrology.
All right. Well, we have a caller on the line. This is Richard from Knoxville. And, Richard, you're on the line with us on Dialogue. Go right ahead.
Hello. I was wondering about the time issue that would be involved in the future about the Einstein's theory and the disparity about, eventually, yes, mankind will reach Mars and further, but the disparity in Einstein's theory of relativity involving a timeline.
Okay, well, I will pass that right along to our experts here on the subject. Now, this is something that kind of goes beyond specifically what we're talking about here. We have a geologist, we have a stargazer, we have an astrophysicist or a star guy. Dr. Guidry, you want to take that one?
Yeah. I'm not sure that I quite understand the question. What discrepancy are you talking about with respect to the general theory of relativity?
Oh, we already lost his call.
Oh, okay.
That's okay. Mm-hmm. Well, no, it's an interesting point. He made a reference to humans, for instance, traveling to Mars. And when we look at that, it's not just like going to the moon where you could get there in 3 or 4 days at rocket speeds. Even traveling with the fastest boosters, the fastest rockets that are available, spacecraft would still take about, 6 months or more to reach Mars. And that's going on the short leg of the trip, and so you'd have to stay for a while. And that, I think, to some people probably rules out the idea that we might go further, at least in the near term, because you'd be talking about making an investment of years and years and years. I mean, do you think that things like that, though, would be feasible?
Well, I think that there's a lot of issues involved in actually manned spacecraft missions. I mean, not only is it tremendously difficult, but it is tremendously expensive. And when we talk or even think about the ideas of sending people further and further out into space, at some point you have to realistically commit that these are one-way missions. And then all of a sudden you start reaching a lot of ethical questions. You know, what do you do? Can you imagine all the lawyers involved? You
know, right.
You know, signing paper after paper. You understand we are not coming to get you.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's a lot of very difficult questions that are beyond the simple questions of technology.
Right.
In moving people further out into space.
And that's a fascinating point. Dr. Guidry, I want to get back to you for just a moment. We'll head back to stars for a minute. And something that I've always wondered about is when we talk about stars, we're talking about vast distances away from the Earth. In some cases, we're seeing back almost to the beginning of the universe in terms of billions of light years away, which is a considerable distance. And I know that, of course, that a light year is the distance that the light can travel at its speed in the course of 1 year. So when you say a billion light years, that's a great distance away. How do you know that the light is that old when it reaches the Earth? How do you make those measurements?
Well, the most distant measurements, the distance of the most distant objects are primarily based on what's called the redshift, which is the shift in the frequency of the spectral lines that's caused by the expansion of the universe. So it is a scientific interpretation, which is fairly consistent in that there are a number of interlocking things that are required to be true in order to interpret things in this way. But what that indicates is that the most distant light that we see is indeed billions of coming from objects that are billions of light years away, not individual stars at that distance, but we can see galaxies at that distance.
And I should point out that the redshift is a phenomenon observed when the light coming from a given object or objects looks a little redder than it should. It's a little bit of a shift that indicates that it's moving away from us, right?
Yes, that's correct. That in the technically in the spectrum associated with the light, there are lines, and those lines are shifted relative to the position that we would see the corresponding lines from a source in the laboratory on Earth. And astronomers, when it's shifted to longer wavelengths, which is what we see in cosmology, astronomers refer to that as the redshift.
There you go. We have an interesting question, this one from Paul in Lenore City, who's asking about Hubble's vision span, if we may see it. It's an amazing spacecraft. We referred to it at the top of the program, that is coming up on the end of its lifespan, but over the last two decades has turned in some amazing, amazing material. And has been repaired so that it gets better and better over time. So how far can Hubble see? Where is its eye chart, let us say? How far can it see?
Okay, it's a somewhat ambiguous question because what astronomers actually deal in is redshift, because it is a somewhat model-dependent issue to convert a redshift, which is an observable quantity, to a distance. And you can see that there are issues with even defining a distance whenever you're dealing with objects that are that far away. You obviously can't stretch a tape measure from here to there, for instance,
sure,
in the usual sense. So astronomers typically deal with redshifts, and I think the largest redshift that has been seen to this point is about 7 or 8, which is corresponds to, if you try to convert it to distances, somewhere in the 10 to 15 billion light-year range.
Which is almost at the beginning of the universe,
yes,
15 billion years.
That's... It corresponds to objects that were emitted that light not very long after the formation of the universe in the Big Bang.
That is amazing. And so I can't conceal my amazement at that. That's incredible. Dr. Kay, we'll come back to you for a minute. Go back to Mars, a little closer to home. We'll pull it back to Mars. And we've been talking about some of the interesting analyses that have been coming out. Some of our listeners probably remember this was a story that was broken on NPR. And when I say broken, I mean it first came out on NPR. And it turns out the story was kind of broken when it did, that there was going to be a big, huge announcement from Curiosity, and this was going to change everything. But it turns out we kind of got that wrong. Could you walk us through what happened there?
Yeah, it's the fault of being a nerd. I mean, when it comes right down to it, it's the difficulty of putting 200, 250 nerds in a building together. Last fall, the project leader for the MSL mission, John Grotzinger, who's a professor at Caltech, was enthusiastic, incredibly enthusiastic about some of our first analyses of the soil that we had scooped. But it wasn't the results of the analyses that he was excited about. It was that all of the equipment worked, and it worked perfectly. And he said, this is going to be one for the history books. And there was a reporter nearby who took this is going to be one for the history books as the results were going to be one for the history books, rather than we have just sent the most complicated analytical equipment out of our own airspace and to the surface of another planet, and everything is working beautifully.
So he was excited about the technology. The reporter thought he was talking about some big, huge
about the results
announcement,
yes.
Right? So we finally got that whole thing straightened out for that, and that also kind of points to the idea that now, it's again going back to the Apollo missions that went to the moon, those could be conducted in a matter of about 2 weeks. You send them out there, you spend a couple of days on the moon, you orbit the moon, you come back, and the whole thing is over with in about 2 weeks. When you're talking about interplanetary exploration to Mars, to Venus, Mercury, the outer planets, it's a marathon, not a sprint. This is going on for months and for years, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, that it is a marathon and not a sprint has been what every team member keeps reminding each other, because we get into these periods of time where either things are really exciting or very busy in terms of what we're doing, and we work until we're about ready to fall over. And you have to sometimes look at your friends and tell them, calm down, go home, sleep for a while. Mars is still going to be there tomorrow. Because our nominal mission is 2 years, and we're only about 10 months into the first year. But with this rover, it could go on for many years after that.
And we learned that with Spirit and Opportunity, the
Absolutely.
Smaller rovers in 2004. I think Opportunity is still driving around up there.
It was meant to last for 9 months, mm-hmm. nominal mission, and it's been up there for more than 9 years.
Oh, that's incredible. That's fantastic. And actually, this brings up an interesting point. You're talking about Mars will still be there tomorrow. It may be, but at the moment, or very close to this moment, it's behind the sun.
Actually, we just came out.
Oh, okay. All right.
So conjunction is a period of time where Mars is obscured by the sun. So its pathway in its orbit is at the other side of the sun. And so for most of the month of April, we got some breathing room. And we just came out of conjunction on May 1st. Mm-hmm. And we spent a couple of days uploading some new software and are getting back down to the business of science.
There you go. But you had a nice—and let me ask you, what happens? Is that like a summer vacation? You guys get to go out and play? Or is it just crunching the numbers for the month that you cannot see Mars on the other side of the sun?
I wish. I have spent the last month working harder than I think I've worked in the last 10 years. Basically, we had 1 month where we didn't have any surface operations, and so the project all got together and said, now's time to publish everything. And so we have been writing papers at 15, 17 hours a day during our vacation.
Mm, my gosh. Well, we'd love to take your questions right now if you've got questions about space, everything from the tip of your nose to the edge of the observable universe. You can give us a call at 974-5050. You can also go online and submit your questions on Twitter. Tweet us at WUOTFM, or you can submit your question on Facebook. That's facebook.com/WUOTFM. Angela Quick, I want to talk to you for just a minute about something cool that's going to happen a little later this year. We're talking about Comet Eisen. It was discovered just last September. I mean, this comet's been around for billions of years. We didn't know about it until just a few months ago, and now it is careening toward the inner solar system, our neck of the woods, for a rendezvous with the sun. Tell us a little bit about this comet.
I'm ashamed to say I have not done much research on this comet, having been researching mm-hmm. the last comet that we got, right?
Mm-hmm.
Comets are all around us, as you say, and we don't know about most of them that are coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Just like the asteroids that were over Chelyabinsk-Sereshka, no one knew that was coming. Everyone was focused on a different asteroid that was coming in. The thought is that Comet Eisen will have the chance at being the next greatest and best for people to view naked eye. We have some famous comets that periodically reappear in our sky. Comets are balls of ice. They orbit around the sun, but not in the same orbit as the planets, usually. They return. So Halley's Comet, a very famous comet, comes back on a regular interval.
Mm-hmm.
Many of these comets are known to come through. They leave a trail of dust behind that causes meteor showers on a regular basis.
Right.
But there's a lot of little bits of stuff floating around out in space, and every now and then we discover one new. It's probably been there before, but we just don't have records of it having been there before. Comet Eisen is coming in, and the thought is that it will be bright enough to see with your eyes alone, which is the big event for comets. Usually they require some sort of magnification, whether that's telescope or binoculars to see. Eisen looks like, from most of the habited northern hemisphere, like it will be a very bright and visible comet, but we won't know until it actually shows up.
That's an excellent point, because sometimes predictions can go bust. Comet Kohoutek in 1973 didn't live up to expectations at all. It went from comet of the century to dud pretty quickly. It's very difficult to predict how a comet, especially one that we've never seen before, like Eisen, will react when it gets very close to the sun. But the hope, I guess, is that we'll see something pretty spectacular in about November or so.
That is correct.
All right. I'm excited about that. How should we view a comet like that? You said naked eye, but I imagine telescopes, binoculars would also be pretty good for that.
Yes. And in fact, the larger the magnification and the larger the light gathering capacity of any tool you use, the sooner you'll be able to spot it
mm-hmm.
and the longer it'll hang around. So there are people out there who have observatory-based personal systems or people out there who have really large amateur systems who are hoping to be the first to spot, if you will. So there's kind of this race as things fall within the capabilities of different ranges of amateur equipment. People are out there to post their observations about when did I see it and what did it look like and could I get an image of it? Because, of course, a camera is a much more sensitive tool than our eye. So there will be people who are posting pictures maybe before you can see it with your eyes of what this looks like. We'll get closer and closer to the point where you can find it with a small amateur instrument. Then one night maybe it'll show up through binoculars or someone will say, I saw this smudgy thing in the sky. Mm-hmm. What could that be? That's when people say, oh, it's here. And we get to decide, is it a big deal or not? And then it moves away from us. And there's the opposite effect of people kind of forget about it with naked eye. And then you'll have a few people saying, oh, I can still see it in my scope. And then it'll fade out until it's only people with very large equipment who are studying it scientifically who'll be interested in looking at all.
Awesome. Well, Chris is on the road with us near Crossville. Chris, go right ahead with your question on Dialogue.
Excellent. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Fascinating program. I just wanted to inquire, I guess stepping back to the Mars missions, Curiosity has found a number of interesting things about the geology and the history and perhaps the habitability of the planet. My question really goes back to the Viking missions. Gil Levin's LR experiment, the label release experiment that gave us some ambiguous results. In recent years, with things that we've discovered about Mars, those results, it's been argued, I guess, that those results might have been taken as more an indication of actual biological activity. My question is, why have we not, given those results from that mission, in the last 40 years, sent another life detection package on any of the rovers? And it's only been about, you know, looking at the habitability in the environs rather than, another something to either refute or support those LR findings from the Viking.
Well, that's a great question, Chris. And this actually gets to something Curiosity, you said, is looking indirectly, Dr. K, for signs of things like water, which we know is a building block for life, and not like directly, like with a microscope looking for microbes. So tell us about kind of the difference there.
Well, I think that there's one thing that we have to keep in mind first. Even Viking was not a life detection mission. Viking found some interesting reactions that could easily involve organic material. But there's a lot of different sources of organic material. There is abiotic organic material. This is organic compounds that are simply made as byproducts of the processes that happen in a planetary system. It's much harder to actually detect life. And so with the Curiosity mission, what we're trying to do is build as detailed of an inventory of all of the things necessary for life. Water is clearly one of them, and we have several lines of evidence now of water in Gale Crater. Another one, if we go back to nutrients and energy, one of the things that biological systems will often utilize is changes in chemistry or changes in redox state or the oxidation or reduction of different elements. And we actually have evidence now in Gale Crater of there being, for instance, the element sulfur in both oxidized and reduced states. And this is a chemical reaction that biology could and does on Earth utilize. But how do you actually find life? And that is so much more difficult. Even if we think about the Earth, and most of my work is studying rocks that are about 1.5 billion years old, so not even as old as the rocks in Gale Crater. And even detecting life on a planet where we knew that there was abundant life is incredibly difficult. There's this process called taphonomy, which is basically everything that happens to an organism after it dies. And that process is incredibly destructive, and it is so difficult to be declarative about any statement about something being life.
Wow. There you go. And so hopefully, Chris, that answers your question about that. William on the line from Kingston, if you can hold on for just a second. We're going to pause right now for a station break at 39 and a half minutes after 1 o'clock Eastern Time. This is Dialogue from WUOT News. Thank you. 20 minutes before 2 o'clock on a Wednesday afternoon, this beautiful afternoon in May. Brandon Hollingsworth with you on Dialogue from WUOT News. William, you've been very patient, and Kingston, go right ahead with your question.
Yeah, good afternoon.
Afternoon.
Thanks for the show.
Oh, no problem.
Great program. As an amateur stargazer, I use some internet resources, for information, and I was recently at the Hubble site, and a while back they pointed Hubble at a spot in the sky where they saw nothing, and they did a long-term exposure. Would y'all please comment on what they saw out there?
Absolutely. This is called the Hubble Deep Field. I can answer that one. All right, and Angela Quick, you're our stargazer. What did Hubble see when it looked into what looked like nothing?
It did not see nothing. In fact, what it saw was a vast field of galaxies, very distant. They had no idea that it would be there. And this was the scientific event on the Hubble missions that changed their focus to thinking, well, maybe instead of following a predetermined set of research objectives, we've got the equipment there. Maybe we should allow some time just to scan the skies and take pictures and see what might be there with an instrument we've never had before. That's what the Deep Field started. And if you go to the Hubble sites on the website and look at all the pictures that they found, you'll see what the results of that were.
Oh, it's a very populated universe out there. I mean, it's just quite amazing that happened. And Angela, I want to stick with you for just a minute. You know, I love to take my own small reflector telescope out on clear nights and look up and look at the moon and various planets. But, of course, I live in Knoxville, so we have issues like light pollution. We have buildings and trees that obscure the horizon. What are some areas here in East Tennessee that the city slickers like myself can go out and really enjoy the night sky the way it's supposed to be, get away from the light pollution?
Well, we're very fortunate that anytime you leave the valley of the Tennessee, we're surrounded by some of the darkest skies in the eastern half of the United States.
Oh.
You go up into the Cumberland Plateau, up to Big South Fork, a national recreation area, very dark skies. Conversely, if you're willing to take a trip down to the Cherokee National Forest or the Great Smoky Mountain National Park, and you have equipment that you can slog in with you and slog back out especially, you'll be able to see very dark skies from over the national park. There are things at Sky at Night that give you a sky map. If you look to see, you can kind of pick out some of those dark spots. Bandit Creek Campgrounds and the Cherhala Skyway are the two darkest places I know of around here. But even if you can just go up on the Foothills Parkway between Maryville and Townsend and pull up any place where the lights of the valley and our big cities fall out of view and you can look east over some place where we don't generate a lot of light as humans, you'll see much darker skies and much more interesting things. The nemesis in Tennessee is actually not just the skies, but the weather.
Oh,
how much
true.
Rain have we had in the last couple weeks?
Tell me about it, yeah.
So that is honestly what astronomers here, amateur astronomers, fight the most, is the weather. Because if it's not actively wet and raining, we have a high humidity and haze. And those are challenges for us.
Indeed. We have a question that was submitted on Facebook. This one from Jacob Ramsey. It says, looking forward to the next steps in space exploration. He says, what can we expect for space travel in the private sector? This is something that will be influencing the way we conduct these missions. Dr. K, of course, you're working on a NASA mission. That's a government project. But private sector is making some inroads into doing some of this stuff. What do you see on that horizon?
You know, I am not very familiar with all of the attempts that are going on. I know that there's a lot of ambition and a lot of hope, and there's a lot of private enterprises that are working and in part contracting with NASA to construct vehicles that can go into space, but I'm not really sure where the frontier lies.
I think it's safe to say that that it may be some partnership between the two, like you were talking about, that would have some elements of both, sort of the creativity of the private sector, but perhaps the financial resources of a government agency.
Well, it almost has to, and in part of that's simply the aspect of the launch vehicle. You know, NASA has, and in fact contracts with a launching agency, and so, you know, making something that can go into space and actually getting it there are two very different questions and two very different expertises. So I think it is going to be a contractual relationship.
John, on the line with us from Knoxville, you're on Dialogue.
Yes, I was wondering about Hubble's expansion of the universe. How do we know how fast it expanding. In other words, the Doppler effect on a train, whether it's 30 miles an hour or 60 miles an hour, is going to be different.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So how do we know the distance determined by the rate of expansion?
All right. A great question. And Dr. Guidry, we covered this a little earlier in the hour, but perhaps might be helpful again to sort of look at you're analyzing light waves that are coming in from distant objects. And so what do you see when you look at those light waves that gives you those indications of distance and speed and motion?
Yeah, well, as I said earlier, the primary thing that you analyze for those distant objects is the so-called redshift, which is the quantitative shift of the position of spectral lines that is related to the distance of the object. So that is basically how we determine that the universe is expanding. And the more recent exciting discovery that was first hinted at in the late 1990s and is now confirmed by a number of other observations is that not only is the universe expanding, but the expansion is accelerating. And that was a tremendous surprise because naively most people expected that the expansion should be decelerating because of the gravitational attraction of all of the galaxies for each other. And basically there are two kinds of observations that led to those results. One is the observation of objects that are called type 1A supernovae, and they are very bright exploding stars. And because of their properties, they can be used to determine distances rather precisely. And those were the first observations in the late 1990s that gave us a hint that the universe is not only expanding, but that the rate of that expansion is increasing with time. And then since then, the cosmic microwave background has been analyzed in considerable detail from satellites above the atmosphere largely. And the detail of fluctuations in the cosmic microwave background also indicates that the universe is accelerating. And this is a very strange result because it is almost as if you imagine throwing a ball in the air. And when you throw a ball in the air, it goes up some distance, it slows, eventually stops and falls down. This would be analogous to throwing a ball in the air, and the higher it goes, the faster it goes. And actually, in terms of general relativity, the theory that explains this, or we think can explain it, is called the theory of dark energy. And the theory of dark energy actually leads to gravity becoming repulsive. And that's something we have never seen before. All of our previous experience is that gravity is always attractive between any two masses. But the presence of this dark energy appears, if you insert it into the equations of general relativity, it indicates that the expansion will accelerate, and the physical reason for it is it turns the normally attractive gravitational force into a repulsive force, and anti-gravity, if you wish.
All right, John, thanks for that question. And that gets into such interesting territory, because now we're moving into kind of theoretical physics about what is dark energy? How does that operate? And those are still questions that are very much under debate right now.
Yeah, the answer is very easy. I don't know. Both dark matter and dark energy are probably the two fundamental issues in modern cosmology, understanding what they are. We have, although they have similar names, they're actually very different things, except that they are unified in the sense that we don't know what either one is. We have very strong observational evidence of the presence of dark matter and dark energy from the gravitational interactions, but we really do not know what it is, except that we are pretty certain that neither dark energy nor dark matter can be any of the matter or energy that we are used to dealing with on the Earth. It is something completely different that we have never yet observed on the Earth, and it is a mystery at this point exactly what they are.
See, now I'm going to be kept up at night wondering about it. No. That's an excellent point, and that was actually a question that I wanted to ask you. I'm so glad that our caller, John, brought it up anyway. Because it does sort of fly in the face of whatever you would think would happen. The ball analogy was a fantastic example of that. What are some other big outstanding questions about cosmology that you would like to see answered or at least make significant progress to answering in the next 10 years or so? What are you looking for that would really just knock your socks off?
Well, if we broaden the question, not only cosmology, which deals only with the largest scales in the universe, but also on somewhat smaller scales, still very large compared to what we're used to dealing with, there are many things that we do not understand very well. For instance, where did the elements come from? And the elements are, of course, essential to chemistry. They're essential to biology. They're essential to physics on the Earth. And yet we have only a rough idea of where the elements actually came from. We are pretty sure that the Big Bang produced only hydrogen and helium. So that means that everything, all of the other elements in the universe were produced in stars in the subsequent history of the universe. And we understand an outline how that happens, but we don't understand the details at all. And this is a more than abstract scientific interest, of course, because our bodies could not function without the iron and the carbon and other heavier elements in our bodies. And those elements were produced in stars, and we only know approximately how they were produced and how they were distributed in the universe.
Wow. Dr. Kay, obviously a ton of questions on Mars, and you were outlining some of those questions a little earlier this hour. As we continue to progress with Curiosity's mission, what questions would you like to see definitively answered?
Definitively, I don't actually believe in terms of science. I'm sorry about that.
To your satisfaction, perhaps.
This is very much an exploratory mission, and I think, you know, as I try to tell my graduate students, any good science project, any good thesis, any good master's thesis, and even more so for a PhD dissertation, will actually create more questions than it answers. And so we're there with a very specific mission. But every time we analyze a sample, every time we look around or drive to a new place, we're creating a lot of new questions, even amongst the science team. And so, you know, right now we've been spending a lot of time trying to understand regional relationships between different rock units. That's something that is of great interest to me, but right now sitting in one place is not answerable. Mm-hmm. And so I'm hoping that as we turn around and drive towards the base of Mount Sharp, and as we travel over different rock units, we'll be able to better understand these relationships and be able to ultimately put together and build a better story about early Mars.
Right. And that points to an interesting question that you sometimes, I'm sure, maybe have heard from people, but certainly I hear it a lot keeping up with media coverage of space issues. There's always the question, well, what's in it for me? What's going to come out of this? You know, what you're talking about is a much broader sort of mission that is just dedicated to asking these questions and gathering data without a specific goal of saying, well, this is, you know, it's going to create better cell phones or whatever.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Except we can't forget that cell phones, computers, all of these actually came out of the space race to begin with. You know, the miniaturization of analytical equipment that we have done for this rover is stuff that has never been done before. And we don't know where that's going to take us in terms of society, in terms of medical research. I mean, much of this is analytical equipment that we would use across a lot of different fields of science. And the miniaturization may really lead us to different goals.
All right. Angela, are you, can you answer a question for us?
I can.
Okay, all right. I know. I hope you're okay over there. No, I just wanted to get back to you for a second and pose the same question to you. You were talking about what's not to love about looking up at the night sky. What are some questions you would like to see answered by researchers in the next 10 years?
Most of the issues I'm concerned with do not have to do with the science aspect at all, but rather with our view of our place in the universe as human beings. One thing that anyone who does amateur astronomy is very aware of is the conundrum of dark skies. You asked, where can I go and look up with my telescope? Mm-hmm. And the answer is there are still some places available, but they are rapidly disappearing. You know, just as we have species rapidly disappearing and resources rapidly disappearing, one resource we have that's rapidly disappearing is a dark night sky. If you went back to the 1930s, everyone would have been able to walk outside and look up and see the Milky Way, unless you were in New York City or London or some very concentrated, relatively small urban area. You could see the night sky, and in fact, you would see the night sky because without artificial lighting, that's all that's there, and it's part of everyone's daily experience. one reason I developed the classes that I did at Maryville College is I hope to inspire people to go outside and look up and try to connect with something that's been a part of human heritage for millennia, but is now rapidly disappearing because of light pollution and the fact that we expand to take so much space.
You know, the physicist Richard Feynman, years ago, somebody once asked him, and I hope the story is not apocryphal because I like it so much, but somebody once asked him, you know, how do I get my kid interested in science? And Feynman's famous reply was, I'm not worried about getting kids interested in science. They're natural investigators. I'm worried about adults. Adults are the ones who stop asking questions. So as a member of a local group dedicated to astronomy among people who are not professionals, how do you get adults and kids, let's throw kids in there too, interested in the subjects that you talk about?
I think there's a bunch of different ways. We have the outreach that comes from Hubble, right? That comes from NASA's really amazing public relations office. That's a good start. We have programs like this where you sit down and you talk about it. Yeah, you get a conversation going. We have public events that are hosted by the Smoky Mountain Astronomical Society. The national parks also do part of this. They have dedicated dark sky locations and star parties that go with those. A star party is basically a gathering of individuals, large gathering of individuals, where amateurs bring their equipment and publicize it'll be open for viewing for the public. So you host those sorts of events, and between the media capabilities that go with having internet presences for scientific endeavors and the local outreach opportunities of just going to a star party, there are lots of ways to get people interested.
Exactly right. Do you find you have a lot of converts at those events? People who, well, I'm just here for my kid, and then they look through the telescope and, wow, you know.
Absolutely. And it's usually the moon or Saturn that does it. I have not seen anyone look at Saturn through a telescope and not say, oh, wow, that's amazing.
That's right. And Dr. Guidry, the Astronomy and Physics Department at the University of Tennessee, does viewings on certain Friday nights of the month, yeah?
Yeah, we have a number of outreach programs led by Paul Lewis. And he does a number of observing things, some for our astronomy classes, but also some for the public. I think probably on Friday nights, but maybe not this summer, but during the regular semester, you can contact the physics department to see the exact schedule. He also does a number of observing things like going to Big South Fork and so on to get to better observing conditions and takes groups of people to do that. He also often goes out to schools and so on to interest children in schools and in observing.
Yeah. We started off this hour by asking all of you what you found exciting about what it is you do. Is there also sort of a sense of excitement in sharing that with others, Dr. Kay?
Oh, absolutely. You know, I have to say, even if I don't have the gene that says, oh my gosh, it's Mars, there is something undeniable about extraterrestrial systems, about planetary systems, about other galaxies that draws in the attention and the excitement of people. And when I go out to Farragut Primary to my son's second grade classroom and I bring red blue glasses and 3D images of Mars, you can just, I mean, it's palpable. Actually, it gets very loud. I mean, the kids are so excited to be able to see Mars in three dimensions. And it's a wonderful outreach tool.
Oh, wonderful. Well, this hopefully has been as well. Dr. Mike Guidry of the University of Tennessee, Angela Quick of Maryville College, Dr. Linda Kay of Mars, and of the University of Tennessee. Thank you to all of you for being with us today on Dialogue. We appreciate it so much. And thank you for joining us on Dialogue as well. Thanks to our producer, Greg Hill, who also answers our phones, and our intern, Lauren Blankenship. We are sorry to say it's her last week with us, but she's going on to bigger and better things after graduation. Thanks so much, Lauren. And thanks to all of you for calling in with your questions, your tweets, and your Facebook messages as well. We'll see you next month on 91.9 FM WUOT Knoxville and WUOT HD1 Knoxville. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. An afternoon concert with Alan Elstrom is next.